is called to order, and welcome everybody. We're going to start off today with a work session. I'm going to open a work session on Senate Bill 1079A. We had a couple people that didn't get to come up yesterday, and I'm going to call them up. And we have Dan Clem, Paul Don Hefner, and Rod Harder, and Patrick. Want to kind of update us on what we have?
Yes, thank you, Madam Chair. Senate Bill 1079A before you. You see the staff measure summary lists summaries for the -A8 amendment and the -A9 amendment. If you would like to scratch the word A8 and replace it with A11, the -A11 amendments fix a small error that was in the -A8s that was a line reference. The -A11 amendments now are the ones that revise the definition for domestic customer and foreign customer, clarifies that it's the purchaser rather than the card issuer who is responsible for certifying the use of fuel is exempt from the tax, and clarifies the certification is made to the seller rather than the department. The A11 amendment then is the amendment to the portion dealing with the card lock stations themselves. The A9 amendment then is the amendment that deals with the ethanol portion. It clarifies and expands the list of exemptions for ethanol blended gasoline requirements. I believe we have our panelists who can speak. Mr. Clem and Mr. Don Hefner should be able to speak to those.
Okay. We'll go ahead and let Mr. Harder go ahead first.
Chair Breyer, members of the committee, for the record, I'm Rod Harder. I live in Salem. I advised the chair yesterday afternoon I would not talk about guns, and she said maybe you should, it would be less controversial. I'm here today, Johnny come lately, and only as a boat owner and not representing anyone else, just to talk about the ethanol situation. I've handed you a Coast Guard safety bulletin called Clean in the Gas. And it outlines a number of different issues that the Coast Guard has identified with the problems experienced in other states. Now, after listening to the doom and gloom yesterday, I went home and did a little more research, so I promised I'd only speak for a minute, but I'm going to extend that just a little. starts off by saying the ethanol issue is a good news for farmers and fuel filter manufacturers, but it's not very good situation for boat owners. We heard about aircraft yesterday, but there was little said about the marine ends of things. And the issues there are as bad as aircraft. You can't call the towing company when your boat breaks down if you're out on the ocean. You can, but as you'll see in that handout from the Coast Guard, many insurance companies have said they will not insure ethanol-covered incidents. In other words, if your fuel line deteriorates, if your gas tank deteriorates, you have a failure at sea, you burn up, they're not going to cover you if those things are related to ethanol use. Experiences in New York, Connecticut, Hawaii have all resulted in changes to the law. And I think yesterday we heard enough of that. We also heard about the phase separation and all the things, the bad things that happen with the gas. A couple of things we didn't hear about is that it does, in fact, deteriorate fiberglass gas tanks. And I have two boats, and both of them have fiberglass gas tanks. So I'm not real sure about where all the other tens of thousands of boat owners are going to go on that issue. One of the other things that we haven't considered, I don't think, is we have tens of thousands of boats in Oregon sitting in moorage right now with their tanks half full to full of current fuel, which does not mix with E10. The reason for that is conventional wisdom has always been you fill your gas tank up to reduce the condensation during winter months. So those boats are stored there. We have thousands more boats stored on trailers who are going to be towing those boats someplace and looking for a place to get gas that they can use in their current outboards. I'm not going to belabor this a lot longer, but I've got concerns as to whether or not the free market is going to be able to step in soon enough to take care of this. Kind of like the short-haul railroads not being able to get their boxcars on the line that we heard from yesterday. I'm not sure that some of the big operators are going to take the time or spend the money to get this put into place. Then there's a question, I think, of liability. Boat owners are clueless. I was clueless until just a month or so ago about this particular issue. I burned ethanol in my gas tanks ever since it's been available in the cars. In the vehicles, and never had any problem with it. So when I saw this issue come up, I thought, well, it's just another law. It's a good thing for the environment, one thing or the other. And I paid no attention to it until about 2 months ago or a month ago, when people started climbing all over me about what's going on. When the boating public finds out about this, I think there's going to be considerably more reaction than you've seen just this week. The good news is that all of the reports say the more you use the boat, the better off you are. So if I retire and go fishing every day, then I'll be out of the picture. But that's probably not an option for me or the rest of the folks. One of I don't know if the new amendment has anything about marinas in it, but they were not excluded in the Dash 6s. And the fuel box at the marinas, I think, should be included in that exclusion. The only, suggestion is to fix this was the one that came up yesterday about exempting premium, and that would be an immediate fix if that were to be exempted, and having 5% ethanol in the mid-range. So when you mix the premium with the regular, then you'd end up with that 5% there. That's the only, I don't know, I've not heard a lot of support for that approach. I don't think there's a lot of interest in it. Probably would be the hard thing to do, but it might be the right thing to do. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Okay.
Go ahead. Madam Chair, members of the committee, I'm Paul Don Hefner, Director of the Marine Board. We share the concerns that you just heard from a boat owner regarding the effects of E10 on boats in the marine environment. We did participate in the working group that met last week. We support the Dash 9 now amendments that add the term watercraft to the exemptions in Section 4 of the bill. E10 does pose some unique problems for marinas and watercraft. As you heard yesterday, ethanol is a solvent. There are documented cases of fuel tank failures in fiberglass fuel tanks on boats, and many boats do have fiberglass tanks. The risk of fire or explosion, one of those tanks leaking into the bilge of a boat, is real. Poses a tremendous risk of a fire explosion, and not to mention the expense of repairing or replacing those tanks. The real problem, the other real problem for boats is the fact that ethanol absorbs water extremely well, 100 times more than current blends of gasoline, and you heard about the problem of phase separation. As little as 2 teaspoons of water in a gallon of gas will cause ethanol to trigger this phase separation. About 75% of the ethanol separates from the fuel mixture. The ethanol and water settle to the bottom of the tank, and if it reaches the fuel pickup, the engine will quit. Once that phase separation takes place, there's no amount of stirring or additives that can be put into the tank to bring the mixture back. The entire tank needs to be siphoned, disposed of, and refilled. And there are documented cases in other states of engine failures, fuel line problems, clogged fuel filters that cause engines to abruptly stop. If that happens at the wrong place in the wrong time, crossing the Columbia River Bar, for example, or while you're crossing in front of a container ship, if your engine were to quit, the result would be disastrous. So we're here to support the amendments that add watercraft. We think that will also allow marinas to sell fuel. I think the only other concern that remains, and you've heard it from other witnesses here, is whether the market will provide ethanol-free fuel in a widespread fashion for boat owners and the other exempted uses that are in Section 4 of the bill. If that doesn't happen, then the permissive nature of them kind of leaves people high and dry. Be happy to answer any questions you have.
Thank you. We'll go ahead and
Madam Chair, members of the House Transportation Committee, my name is Dan Clem. I'm the Director of the Department of Aviation. You heard testimony yesterday spelling out all the problems involving ethanol in fuel used in aircraft. I don't need to belabor the point that when the engine stops on a plane, it's a fatal situation. So the severity and cautiousness with the fuels containing ethanol are not optional for aircraft. There needs to still be a market for fuel that has no ethanol in it. There are enough planes, there are enough pilots out there that cannot tolerate ethanol of any type in the plane. There are a number of engines, more and more so, that are tolerating a 5% plan, the Rotax engines, but the predominant amount that are out there that are in rural parts of the United States don't have the option of even considering it. So, again, I want to express the concerns that the Oregon Aviation Board has, such that we do whatever we can to create and support a market that still provides an unblended fuel. And I think we believe that the Dash 9 Amendment is a step in the right direction to creating that marketplace so that that unblended fuels can still be made available to enough in a dispersed sense throughout the state of Oregon. Many of Oregon's airports, there are 400 airports, 97 of them are public use. The other 300 of them are anywhere from just a small private strip to an agricultural strip. Rural Oregon doesn't have the ability to enjoy a more robust fuel distribution system that we do here in the urban areas. And the concern there is they've only got one tank. And when they fill up, hopefully a lot of that use, all that use is off-road, and the Dash 9 Amendment allows them to continue to the fuel distributor to carry and for them to still continue to fill up with an unblended fuel. The Dash 9 Amendment allows all the different kinds of aircraft to be able to do that. The aircraft industry, general aviation, has seen a number of transitions through the years. Different kinds of fuels. At one point in time, most of America was flying small planes from agricultural strips, or even the mail planes back in the 1920s. They could only get car gas. That hasn't changed 100 years later. There is still only car gas in much of rural America. The fuel that they use for not only airplanes is the same that they put sometimes in their farm tools and their ATVs that they use in rural Oregon. So I want to emphasize the fact that we think that keeping somewhat of an infrastructure, at least for a number of years, with an unblended fuel will do that. This bill is different than other states in that it allows unblended gasoline for aircraft, watercraft, and a number of the uses you see outlined in the Dash 9 Amendment. Other states have only exempted premium fuel for off-road use. Oregon exempts both regular and premium for off-road use, if you will. So it allows the marketplace the flexibility and the demand to tell the supply chain to bring unblended fuel to those places where it's predominant. If there's two tanks at a gas station, one can be used for on-road blended fuel and the other can be off-road unblended fuel. Those reasons, we are supporting the Dash 9 Amendment, and I'm happy to answer any questions if I can.
Okay, thank you. Representative Buckley.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, gentlemen. In one of the handouts, the article from Yachty Magazine, there's a line here at the bottom of the article that says, if your boat must be fueled with E10, be sure to add a stabilizing chemical to the fuel each time you add fuel. Are there stabilizing chemicals available in our state widely for boat users?
Madam Chair, Representative Buckley, yes, there are. Currently, I use stabilizer when I put my boat up for the winter. And there are stabilizers available.
Okay, cool. Thank you for that information. I appreciate it, Madam Chair.
Representative Smith.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I have a couple questions. First of all, regarding aviation, if we fail to pass Senate Bill 1079 with the Dash 9 Amendment, what will be the impact on our commercial aviation, specifically up the Port of Portland and PDX?
Madam Chair, Representative Smith, it's unknown at this time what its impact will be on commercial aviation, because most of that is, that's all jet fuel and avgas, which is not affected by Oregon's blending law.
Okay.
Not using gasoline.
Okay.
I'd have to say it's probably none.
Oh, okay. Thank you. And again, I'm very much a novice in the aviation industry. Question for you two gentlemen, though. The citizens that you license, if they are allowed to purchase non-blended fuel rather than the blended fuel, are now going to be required to pay a premium price based on supply and demand. Demand is going to remain constant. Supply, obviously, has decreased significantly. What do you think their reaction is going to be to paying a premium for fuel for their recreational vehicles?
Madam Chair, Representative Smith, well, I can't imagine that anyone's going to be happy about paying more. But I think that some people probably would be willing to spend the extra couple of dollars that it might be to protect their toys, their investment in their various toys, not only watercraft, but ATVs, snowmobiles, a variety of other two-cycle engines that are out there, rather than look at the expense of a ruined engine or worse.
Follow up, Madam Chair. I think you're exactly right. I think folks who own those toys will be willing to pay more dollars. With that said, I don't think they're going to be all that thrilled with the legislature that they're now having to pay more. Right now, it's very expensive for folks who are filling up their watercraft or their ATVs. I can attest to that firsthand. Mr. Harder raised a point about a possible amendment of just exempting premium fuel from the mixture. Do either of you have a comment or a thought on that suggestion?
Madam Chair, Representative Smith, with regard to aviation, there are a number of pilots and pilots' associations who believe that that would be the fix, that it would still guarantee the supply would equal the demand. I will tell you that I'm concerned that there are a number of small aircraft engines that burn regular. They don't burn premium. They're not, and some are not able to. Many of them that burn regular can also burn premium, but there are some that cannot. I'm not sure that just exempting premium in and of itself solves it for everybody. But there is a wide-held belief that if you exempt all premium, you're undoing the basic tenets of the ethanol blending law. But again, if your concern is also about price, you would be allowing premium to now become a premium type fuel, and it may not qualify under the business energy tax credits for fuel infrastructure as well, because it would already be a permitted use. Under this design of the Dash 9 amendment, it allows the marketplace to discern whether or not there's enough demand in that area or for that tank or for that distributor for an unblended fuel of any type.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I look forward to hearing the comments of Mr. Romaine later on this issue, but thank you, gentlemen.
Representative Benz.
Madam Chair, gentlemen, what are your departments doing to make sure the rest of the world knows about these risks? I mean, I don't want to use the legislature as a standard of knowledge, but it would seem that we should have known more before this last bill was passed. What are you doing to make sure other folks know about the dangers that could occur in the event they don't or aren't able to acquire the right kind of fuel? I mean, assuming these amendments pass and everything's great, how are we going to let people know of the danger of in case they can't get their hands on the type of fuel that we hope is still available?
Madam Chair, Representative Vance, we've taken some steps to notify people via our website. We've got information on ethanol blended fuels there and some of the precautions that people can take to avoid phase separation and that. We've also done some press releases that have been carried fairly widely. So those are some of the things that we're doing. In a couple of months, just before Memorial Day, we'll do a statewide newsletter that goes to all registered boat owners, and we'll contain information in that newsletter as well.
Is the, to your knowledge, is the same thing happening with in other departments? I'm most interested in other people who have gasoline engines, not necessarily for boats, not necessarily for aircraft. But there's a lot of gasoline engines out there that aren't going to be. I'm not sure the owners are going to be aware of the danger that this type of fuel presents.
Madam Chair, Representative Bentz, I'm not aware of any other agencies that, for example, do anything with small engines, you know, snowmobiles are registered with registered, so there might be an avenue to get out to them and ATVs, but the lawnmowers, the chainsaws, the rest, I don't believe there's any agency that would be pushing that information.
Madam Chair, Representative Bentz, the work group that we convened over the last couple of weeks, the information was brought forward that a lot of the small engines, the lawnmowers, the hedge trimmers, a lot of those pieces of equipment have been essentially ethanol mix friendly up to 10% in their manufacture since 1996. That's not to defend that there aren't pieces of equipment that are older than that still being used. But within the aviation industry, it's very well known that the aircraft won't tolerate ethanol. Our challenge is to educate and work with the fuel distribution system, the airport managers, and the pilots to ensure that the demand is still strong enough to warrant delivery of unblended fuel.
One last question. It just seems to me that the predictable response of someone determining that this fuel is inadequate is to pour it out, as opposed to appropriately dispose of it. And it seems to me if people are warned in advance, we could reduce the chances of that happening. I'm talking about the smaller engines and everything else.
Thank you. Any other questions for these three? Seeing none. Thank you, gentlemen. And Representative Smith, Mr. Romaine did testify yesterday, but we can bring him back up if you would like. And also, Mark Kendall, did you have anything to add on the other engines? So if you two want to come up.
Want to come up?
That was well, you have been asked to come up. So, Mr. Kendall, if you want to go ahead and if you have something to add.
Representative Beyer and members of the committee, for the record, I'm Mark Kendall, Senior Policy Analyst with the Oregon Department of Energy. And I would like to point out that ethanol fuel is not a new commodity in Oregon's market. In 1991, the Clean Air Act required oxygenates to be used in petroleum, gasoline, automobiles, and urban airsheds that were in non-attainment or in near non-attainment under their implementation plans. And that included Klamath Falls, Portland, as well as Portland and Medford airsheds. And since that time, we've been blending as much as 60 million gallons in any given calendar year into regular as well as premium gasoline that's been distributed throughout the state in some cases. If you bought gasoline from Shell or from ARCO or from as long as 4 years or 5 or 6 or 7 years ago, you likely purchased an oxygenated fuel with 10% ethanol blend. In 1992, all of the small motor manufacturers developed new standards to respond to oxygenated fuel. And in 1996, the Small Motor Manufacturers Association published a journal of its members and a list of over 45 producers of small engines that can use 10% ethanol blends without any compromise to the safety or the performance of the equipment. And it includes outboard motors as well. Granted, that doesn't address older equipment that's in the marketplace, but I have a colleague who drives a 1972 GTO, and he uses ethanol all the time because it gives it oomph. So, I mean, so there are examples where we've seen premature failure of older small engines in the marketplace. We have a place on our website under biomass and biofuels that addresses using ethanol in a range of motors and points to a number of the common Coast Guard and other circulars regarding use of ethanol fuels. But it is not a new fuel in Oregon. It has been blended, and it is something that we should be aware of and wary of and be educating consumers about how to properly use it in the class of equipment that they have.
Thank you. Any questions? Thank you for that. And Representative Smith, do you have any particular questions
you'd
like to ask Mr.
Romney? I do. Thank you, Madam Chair, for your gracious accommodation here. Good seeing you, Mr. Romney. In rural Oregon, is there going to be stations that will provide non-blended fuel for the types of vehicles that we've heard of?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, I'm Paul Romaine, representing the Oregon Petroleum Association. First of all, I want to commend to you the A11 amendments, which have nothing to do with this issue. And which is the original reason for this bill. Okay, that's number one. Number two is, before I get to your question, I want to point out that we sell, we being the distributors and retailers, sell gasoline that's intended for use in motor vehicles. That's what we sell. We have aviation fuel. It's a 100-octane low lead. But what we sell is car fuel. And understand that under no circumstances are we warranting this for use in anything but vehicles. You are doing this in this legislation. I don't want to see the Trial Lawyers Association in the back of the room here. Having said that, the market is an amazing thing. It actually seems to work. And I believe that given a demand, there will be fuel available. I can't tell you that certain places will or will not have fuel, because a particular kind of fuel, because we don't operate that way. I don't know. I don't get involved in the individual business decisions of people here or there or any place else. So if the demand is there, the fuel's going to be there. I guarantee you that. We might have a lot of off-road Maseratis that will be filling up to increase the demand, but we don't know yet. But we will have fuel if the demand is there. If the demand is not there and there's still a problem, then we will let you know that too, probably in the 09 session. But I can't tell you right now whether the demand will be there for this particular fuel. We hope it will be. I know a lot of people that are geared up to be involved in it, but I can predict the past very well, but not the future.
Has there been any type of analysis done to determine what constitutes adequate demand to bring in the supply?
Madam Chair, Representative Smith, not that I know of. We don't. My group are a bunch of dealers and jobbers, and we're not big oil, and we don't have the resources to do that kind of
well,
study.
Tell me if my concern is valid. Fossil Oregon. Community of 450 people has one gas station, but they also have a lot of ATV riders. I'm struggling to believe that fuel station is going to have an adequate enough demand to justify tying up a pump to provide a non-blended fuel to meet the needs of these other pieces of equipment. Is that a justified concern?
Madam Chair, Representative Smith, the best I can say is I'll let you know in a year. I don't know what an adequate demand is going to be for somebody. If you have one tank in the ground, then you've got to make a policy choice, basically. What am I going to sell? Am I going to have something that's unblended, or am I going to have a blended fuel there? You know, probably might take a couple of winks by regulators as they go by when that Maserati is also filling up the ATV. But I can't tell you. I just don't know. If you have two tanks, maybe you'd end up with, you know, splitting them off and just not having a premium or a mid-grade. You would have one unblended and one blended, in effect, regular gas.
I don't even see that occurring. Right now, we have a difficult enough time getting diesel carried in our rural fuel stations, let alone premium, let alone standard fuel. Yeah. Colleagues, I think we've just turned over a rock. I think there's going to be a lot more consequences as a result of the legislation we passed in the last session. And I sure hope in the coming months that more analysis is done on this. I appreciate the answer that was given to us by the Marine Board and by the Department of Aviation, but I don't think that's adequate outreach to these folks who are going to be utilizing or needing to utilize a non-blended fuel. I think there's a lot of folks out there that are going to have pleasant surprises, and they're not going to be so pleasant when all of a sudden their equipment's not operating and they need it to operate, and or that they cause damage to their equipment. These were concerns we heard about. We heard about these concerns in this body for one reason or another, and I throw myself in with that group, obviously. We ignored that. And now Oregonians are going to have their say with us, I have a feeling, in the future. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Representative Buckley.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair. I guess I have a little bit of confusion. Maybe the representative from the Department of Energy can help me out. If I understand your testimony, our market, where Representative Gilman and I have constituents in the Medford market, we didn't experience this kind of horrific occurrence of machinery favored ATVs not being able to operate. In fact, I have people tell me there's way too many ATVs in my district. I mean, it's just part of what's going on in my life right now. Could you address the concern that's been raised about that suddenly we're going to have a whole subset of Oregonians not be able to fuel their vehicles?
I think part of the answer is anecdotal and your experience, as well as there is statistical information which includes the lack of claims associated with Oregon's oxygenated fuel requirement during the winter months, November to May, since 1993. So one thing that we do know is that people regularly filled in the winter, spring, and fall and various seasons in the Medford area, as well as all of the Tri-County Portland metropolitan area, many small vehicles, snowmobiles and ATVs and other vehicles with oxygenated 10% or up to 10%, 9%, 6% in some cases, ethanol fuels. And we did not experience catastrophic failures that are surmised by others' testimony.
I appreciate that, because we do have, my district goes into the Applegate Valley. I mean, I have farmers and ranchers in my district. I haven't heard a single complaint, so it's just... I'm hoping, Representative, that your concerns are unfounded. That's my hope.
I'm just following the concerns that were raised by the Marine Board and the Department of Aviation and their expertise.
Marine tanks that have fiberglass resins, it is a legitimate concern. And aviation engines that are not certified for ethanol use, it's a legitimate concern. When we look at ATVs and these small motors, again, since 1996, the Small Motor Manufacturers Association and its 46-plus members all certify their engines to run on oxygenated fuel. And they include people like Arctic Cat and Honda and Kawasaki and Polaris and Skidoo and Suzuki and Cub Cadet and Bolins and Ryobi and Sears and Tecumseh and Briggs and Stratton. And I can go continually on down the list. And those pieces of equipment represent the bulk of small engines currently in Oregon's market, because that's an 11-year window.
Madam Chair, if I might also comment on Representative Buckley's question or comment. The market responded. I mean, basically, your pilots and your Marine people are probably more aware of what's going on, especially your pilots. I mean,
yeah.
I once went through, at least attempted to start going through pilot training until I realized that I wasn't smart enough to do that. And I mean, you're checking your fuel all the time. You have to really be careful. So you are aware. You're also aware of your sources mm-hmm. of fuel. If you realize something is an ethanol blend and you can't use ethanol in your plane, you are going to find another source. And what we had before were pockets of places where you had ethanol, but maybe the other stuff was available other places. The question here is, are those pockets going to be available? Are we going to be able to, with this demand, create those pockets? And we hope we can. That's a very legitimate question Representative Smith had. And we hope we can, but I can't tell you for sure that we can today. Again, I can tell you a year from now, maybe, but I can't tell you today.
Thank you.
Just the last question.
All right.
Thank you, Madam Chair. On page 3 of the Dash A9 amendments, there's reference to our Class 1 and Class 3 all-terrain vehicles and snowmobiles. Sir, if they're operating fine on a blended fuel, why are we including them in these amendments?
That takes into account the fact that some of the fleet of those pieces of equipment are older than the 96 when manufacturers identified that they were completely compatible with an ethanol blended fuel. Many of those vehicles might also be found on in agriculture. And those pieces of equipment tend to have higher mean average annual maintenance levels, and so they have a longer service life. So it addresses and allows for that.
Okay. Thank you. Representative Gilman, do you have a motion?
I just want to chime in, Representative Buckley, that in Grants Pass, there were a couple of stations that had non-oxy fuel available, and my understanding, I'm a pilot, I burn 100 low lead, and I'm not sure why so many people use car gas except for those engines that require it. The money idea is ridiculous as far as I'm concerned. It's only about $1, $1.50 more a gallon for 100 low lead. And you have an assurance that is something you can use in your airplane. My airplane placard says 100 low lead, and that's what I burn.
Understandable.
Thank you. So, do I have a motion?
Yes. Madam Chair, I move the Dash 9 amendments to Senate Bill 1079, dated 2-18-08.
Thank you. Representative Gilman has moved the Dash 9 amendments to Senate Bill 1079, dated 2-19-08. Any discussion? Seeing none, the clerk will call the roll. Dash 11 amendments are adopted. Another motion then?
And then Dash 8.
11.
Oh, 11. Okay. Madam Chair, I move the Dash 11 amendments to 1079, dated 2-19-08.
Representative Gilman has moved the Dash 11 amendments to 1079, dated 2-19-08. Any discussion? Seeing none, clerk will call the roll.
Aye.
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 Aye. The Dash 11 amendments are adopted. And one more.
Way to go. One more motion to make.
I move House Bill
1079, the floor with a due pass recommendation as amended.
Representative Gilman has moved Senate Bill 1079 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Any discussion?
I want to talk a little bit more.
That's fine.
I happen to have another amendment that would exempt premium gasoline. I think the compromise we've made is the best we can do for this session. If the voters send me back here in 09 and we do not have a supply out there, I am going to be moving towards exemption of premium gasoline. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Representative Gilman. So, with that, the clerk will call the roll.
Aye.
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 Representative Schmidt. Aye. Representative Vice Chair Gilman. Aye. Vice Chair Kilmer. Aye. And Chair Meyer. Aye. Senate Bill 1079 has passed. And would Representative Gilman like to carry this bill?
I'll carry it.
Thank you. And propose the work session on Senate Bill 1079, and we're going to go ahead and open. Informational hearing, and thank everybody for being so patient on the Columbia River crossing. And so we can, right. So we'll have Doug Tindall and John Osborne. You want to come up?
Chair Beyer, members of the committee, good afternoon. Doug Tindall, Deputy Director, Oregon Department of Transportation. I'd like to thank Mr. Romaine for making us pilots sound especially smart or something during fuel. The truth is they have to color code avgas so that we don't smart. That's not what I'm here to talk about today. Mr. Osborne will cover most of the presentation. He's the project director on the Columbia River crossing for ODOT. I just want to set the context for you. This bridge, we call it the Columbia River crossing. It's really the I-5 bridge in between Portland and Vancouver. And this is not just a project by itself. This is part of over a decade of work on the I-5 corridor. This is actually will be the third project undertaken on the I-5 corridor. Oregon has just recently awarded the Delta Park interchange rehabilitation and expansion. Washington has already completed an expansion of an interchange in their on I-5, and so this is just another piece of the puzzle. This is a particularly important piece. It solves congestion problems. It also provides safety solutions to safety problems. There's a lot of crashes on this bridge, and it provides alternatives for travelers that they don't really have today. It does that by expanding the choices for people to get across the river. The project handles increasing demand by using those alternatives for travel and not just forcing people into cars. And so over the course of it, not only does it solve a problem now, it solves a problem over a period of time out into the 2030 time frame, which is what we planned for. It's obviously goes between two states, goes between two cities. We've done this before with the Washington Department of Transportation on the existing bridges that are there now, on the I-205 bridge, and on several other bridges that cross between the two states. And so the states know how to work together to pull off a project of this magnitude and do it successfully. It means both ends meet in the middle, and we are offset, so the lanes don't match up. So we can work with WSDOT to get that accomplished. And the cities of Vancouver and Portland working together, as well as the metropolitan planning organizations on both sides of the river. So that's a context for what you're going to hear about in terms of this project. This is a big project on its own, but it's not just a big project. It's part of a much bigger strategy to keep traffic and freight moving on the I-5 corridor. John, I'll let you talk about we'll take them through the slides.
Okay. Good afternoon, Chair Byers, committee members. I'm John Osborne, and I'm your project director for the Columbia River Crossing Project. The first picture that we show there actually shows a little bit of contrast. We have March of 1965, Hayden Island and viewing into Vancouver. And then contrasting with that, we have today's conditions, and you can see that we've actually built up right next to the highway, and the cityscape in Vancouver has changed considerably since then. So what is the I-5 Columbia River Crossing Project? It is a highway, a bridge, and a transit project that really reconstruct 5 miles of interstate between Columbia Boulevard in Oregon to SR 500 on the Washington side in Vancouver. It includes a bridge, a crossing, and it also includes making sure that we introduce a high-capacity transit system as balanced with the system. There are 6 major interchanges involved with that particular project, and it does have significant connections to 2 deep water international ports, one being the Port of Portland, the other being the Port of Vancouver. The I-5 system and the I-84 system, if you take a look at the next slide, are very important to freight movement in the region. And we can see by the size of, this is almost like an angiogram, we can see by the size of I-5 and I-84 how vital those corridors are to freight movement. 67% of all freight in the region currently is moved by truck, and this is expected to grow to 73% by 2030, and freight volume is expected to double in that time period. The corridor also serves an average of 48 freight trains and 12 passenger trains each day, and over 100 trains are forecasted to be serviced on a daily basis by 2025. If we take a look at the next slide, the bridge influence area really is in the center of the freight hub for the Washington and Oregon communities. In the Portland metropolitan, Vancouver metropolitan areas, we have the confluence of 2 navigable rivers. We have the connections of 2 major railroads, and we have the connections of 2 major interstates. So this particular section is vitally important. We can see the ports. We can see the Portland International Airport. It also is close to it, and this project is right in the middle of all of that. If we take a look at an average afternoon, we can see that within the bridge influence area, we have some of the worst congestion that we have in the Portland metropolitan area. Typically, northbound, any afternoon after about 3 o'clock, speeds are about 15 miles an hour or less. Similarly, in the morning, from SR 500 in Vancouver down through the Delta Park area, we see similar backups. So why do we need this project? Currently, the safety issues are not what we would expect in this particular urban corridor. It's about 2 times the accident rate to what we would see to a facility being built to standard. And on the Vancouver side, it's about 4 times what we would expect right at the bridgehead because of the curvature and because of the amount of bridge lifts that we have.
Madam Chair, will you entertain questions as
yes.
we're getting this?
Sure.
Okay, may I ask a question?
Yes, you may.
Thank you. So can you get us information regarding the crash rates in the rest of the bi-state area? I'd like it compared to what it might be on I-84 or any other areas. You're saying that it's the crash rates are too high compared to what?
Chair Byers, Vice Chair Tomei, yes, we can get you that specific information. The comparison essentially is to a freeway facility that would be built to standard in what we would expect to see and what we have today on the I-5 corridor in the project area.
Yes, my fault. So, as I understand, and I can't remember how many years I was reading, that the traffic will be the congestion will be about what it is now. So then what would you expect the crash rate to be? I'm not saying that very clearly. That now it's very congested in that area in, what, 20, 30 years? Even with the new bridge being built to this size, the congestion will be about what it is now.
Chair Byer, Representative Tomei, a couple of things. The congestion, even in the 2030s, we'll get into that forecast here. It's a little bit less than it is now. But more importantly, you have a couple of things that cause crashes today that you won't have then. One is bridge lifts, which is a cause of crashes. Another is you have narrow lanes today, and they're, so you're substandard in terms of the lanes. And the third thing is you have a lot of weaving of people getting on and trying, while people are trying to get off on another ramp. And the solution that's proposed here will address those things, cut back on the congestion to some extent, also give you standard lane widths, and minimize the weaving.
Great. So. That's very helpful. Thanks, Doug. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Some of the other reasons that we do need the project is to make sure that we have real choices for commuters in the area, and to make sure that we make improvements to our bicycle and pedestrian improvements. One of the things that we do struggle with now is the river navigation. The barge channel currently is under the high span of the bridge, and there's a railroad bridge to the west of the existing I-5 bridges. And if folks aren't making a direct pass through the lift span, then there's what the river folks call the S maneuver, which is particularly difficult to make. And a new project with the replacement bridge would be able to address that particular issue. So how have we engaged with the public on this project? And I'd like to say that really the public involvement with this project has been unprecedented. We're in about a three-year process with this particular phase of the project, this being the third one that came out of the 2002 strategic plan. But since March of 2006, we've engaged with over 10,000 folks, and we've been to over 350 events. We also have a task force that's been very helpful in us moving this project forward. It's a 39-member group of stakeholders that include folks from the community, from the businesses, from governments, from environmental groups, from neighborhoods. It's quite diverse. We also have advisory groups such as the Freight Advisory Group that's helping us with those components, and the Community and Environmental Justice Working Group. So what is the process that we've followed so far in the project and the key milestones? Essentially, we assembled our task force and we talked to a lot of folks in the community. We identified what the problems are on the I-5 corridor specifically that we're going to address. We set what the vision was for the corridor, and we established evaluation criteria that we would use to evaluate alternatives with. And that was over a seven-month process to do that with those stakeholders. It was quite involved, and we made sure that we got adequate input from folks. Then we identified a number of solutions that would be possible, and we screened those using that evaluation criteria. We came up with a set of 12 alternatives that ranged from doing very little highway work and mostly working for a transit solution to the other end of the spectrum of very little transit improvements but mostly highway improvements. We winnowed those down to the most promising alternatives, which were five that were sort of in the middle. And there are two bridge options and two high-capacity transit options that we evaluated, being do we replace the bridge or do we keep the existing bridges and add something else to it? And do we have a bus rapid transit system or do we have a light rail system? Those alternatives went forward, and we've done a lot of work and analysis on those. The results of that study will be released next month in a draft environmental impact statement, which will be put out for public comment. And from the work that we receive, from what we receive back in that process, we will use to help get a locally preferred alternative that is one solution for the project and get political consensus on that. From that point, we expect to be able to complete the environmental process by late in 2009, and then with funding and a record of decision from the USDOT, we would look forward to proceeding with final design, right-of-way acquisition, and construction in the 2009 to 2011 time period. The current choices that currently are on the table for folks to get down to a locally preferred alternative really revolve around what type of bridge structure should we build? Should it be a replacement structure? Should it be a supplemental sort of a structure? And what's the transit mode that we should select? Should it be a bus rapid transit or should it be a light rail system? The other things that are still up for consideration are what's the transit alignment that would make the best sense for the project? In Vancouver, should that be along I-5 or should it be through downtown Vancouver? And on Hayden Island, similarly, should it be close to Hayden Island or should it be further to the west? So aside from the replacement and the supplemental options on the bridge crossing, other things that we did consider and use our evaluation criteria to weed out essentially were things like a tunnel or a new corridor. Should we have an I-605 or make improvements to I-205 or perhaps an arterial crossing? None of those panned out as better solutions for the project. Similarly with transit, we also looked at streetcar and at heavy rail and at commuter rail options, which didn't pan out as well as what either a bus rapid transit or light rail transit system seemed to. So aside from the three major issues that we're looking to make with the draft EIS process about bridge type, bridge mode, and alignment, there are other things that we will continue to work through the process, through the environmental process. Where are the transit stations located? What do they look like? What specific freight improvements are we going to make at interchanges? And what does a bridge look like and what's the alignment that would be there? Very quickly, a replacement bridge alternative would be a new structure that would be slightly downstream of where the existing bridges are that would connect in approximately where both of the bridgeheads are right now. And they would be high enough that we would not have to have lift spans within the bridge. This particular alternative gives us the greatest ability to be able to address the safety deficiencies that Deputy Director Tindall was talking about earlier, and would allow us to take care of the seismic issues, and also helps us to improve river navigation significantly. The supplemental bridge would be the addition of one structure slightly to the west and immediately adjacent to the existing bridges. Northbound traffic would stay on the two bridges that exist today. The lift span would stay there. And then southbound traffic, along with the high-capacity transit component and bicycle, high-capacity transit would go southbound on a structure that was high enough not to have to have a bridge lift in it. And the bicycle and pedestrian facilities would be retrofitted on the existing bridges. What are the safety trade-offs between the two? A replacement bridge really does afford us the opportunity to address almost all non-standard safety issues. It does remove the lift span, and actually, operationally, it results in much less congestion on the system, which I'll talk about a little bit more detail in a minute. The supplemental bridge does allow us to address some non-standard features. It does add new mainline merge and diverge sections, and it does keep a bridge lift and has considerably higher congestion expected. The key findings between the bridge options and a no-build essentially is that with a replacement bridge, we would expect to have somewhere around 3.5 to 5.5 hours of congestion in the year 2030. If we do nothing, we expect 14 to 16 hours of congestion. So there is a considerable improvement with regards to congestion, which leads into better freight mobility and more reliability for the system and better livability for everybody there. And regards to high-capacity transit, the two components that we've been focused on is a bus rapid transit alternative and a light rail alternative. Essentially, a bus rapid transit...
Could you stop just a minute? You've gone through so fast, and I know you're trying to get through quickly. But we're looking at the differences between the replacement and the no-build, and you're talking about person trips. Mm-hmm. So person trips with the replacement bridge means there would be 35,000 people southbound in the morning. If there's a no-build, there is a 26,000 southbound. Tell me about the difference there and why.
Chair Beyer, Representative Tomei, a couple slides back, I believe it's on slide 21, I think shows that shows the hours of congestion and shows how those people move, and you can see that there's a much higher transit component with the replacement bridge than there would be with the no build.
So you're saying these would not be person trips in an automobile. You're saying this would be total person trips. Is that?
Yes, thank you. You're actually giving our presentation quite well. And on page 22, you can see that the number of auto trips in the replacement bridge scenario are actually slightly lower than the no-build alternative because we are providing those alternative choices. Very top section on page 22 is the I-5 bridge, shows the existing condition, shows the no-build being 184,000, shows the replacement bridge being 178,000. So there's actually fewer trips with the replacement bridge, and that's because of the addition of the travel alternatives.
Okay, help if I may, Madam Chair.
Yes.
So fewer people will be coming across the bridge if there's no build.
Chair Beyer, Representative Tomei, that's correct. Fewer people will be coming across the bridge if there's no build. There will be more cars, but there will be fewer people.
Right. So if I can extrapolate, if I may, Madam Chair,
yes,
that then there will be fewer people moving from the Portland metropolitan area to rural Clark County. Would that be a correct assumption?
Chair Beyer, Representative Tomei, I may let John give you a shot at this one. I'm not sure I know the travel pattern in terms of where the origin and the destinations are. I know today that it's about, I think, 65% commute from Vancouver to Portland. Is that right, John? 65,000 commute from Vancouver to Portland, 12,000 from Portland to Vancouver. That's today. And by 2030, that's forecast to even out to some extent. I don't know the exact numbers. Am I getting it at what you're...
Mm-hmm.
You're okay. So I can get you the number that we would project in 2030 in terms of where they're going from and to.
Oh, so are you saying, Doug, that the same number of people in, what did you say, 2040?
2030.
The same number of people will be going from Portland to Vancouver during
I don't believe it's exactly the same, but I know now there's quite a significant difference, more coming from Vancouver to Portland, and in 2030 it's forecast to be more balanced. I don't think it achieves complete balance.
That's correct.
It's closer. There's still more coming from Vancouver to Portland, but it's not as big a difference as it is today.
And if you could get me that information, I'd appreciate it.
We'll
thank
do
you.
That.
Okay. All right.
Okay. Back to the transit components that we're taking a look at. Essentially, the bus rapid transit system would operate in a dedicated bus lane. It would carry approximately 91 folks. Folks would have to transfer at the Expo Center onto the existing yellow line. A light rail option would be an extension of the yellow line essentially into Vancouver, where no transfer would be required and folks would be able to make a continuous trip. Two car trains currently carry about 266 folks. If we take a look at the annual river crossings with regards to transit, under a no-build situation, we expect that number in the year 2030, we expect that to be 2.5 million. If we have a bus rapid transit option with a replacement bridge, we expect 4.8 million folks to be able to utilize transit services. With a light rail component and a replacement bridge, we expect that to be 6.7 million folks annually that cross the river. We did take a look with the supplemental bridge option about what would happen if we increase the transit network, particularly in the Vancouver area, by about 40%. The net result was is we did see about a 10% increase in river crossing, but that came at a huge increase for transit components in Vancouver. So it says there's a real demand for transit in Vancouver, but if we beef it up a lot, it doesn't necessarily mean that more folks use transit to go across the river. So what are the key findings? Essentially, the key findings that we find with regards to the transit mode is that bus rapid transit does have a little bit lower capital costs, but it does have significantly higher operating costs over the life of the system. That light rail does have a higher capital cost, but lower operating costs throughout its lifetime. Light rail does have a higher ridership projection than what a bus rapid transit system does. And essentially, the light rail option would cost about 25% less on a per rider basis over the life of the project.
Quick question for me. The light rail having a higher ridership, is that... I know that on the previous slide that it was a higher capacity for light rail. And is that the main reason, or are there other reasons why you would have a lower on the bus rapid transit?
Chair Beyer, there are other reasons, and part of that is the transfer that has to be made. Folks aren't real excited about getting onto a bus and having to get off of that and wait around a little bit for the light rail connection to take place. And it does take a little bit longer for a bus rapid transit. It's only about 5 minutes at best, but, you know, folks do consider that. So there are other considerations as well.
Thank you.
Looking northbound with regards to mobility, today we have about 4 hours of congestion at the I-5 bridge in the afternoon. If we don't do anything, that essentially will move up to almost 8 hours a day that we would see just in the northbound direction. If we put in a replacement bridge, we expect that that number would be around 2 hours of congestion that we would see in the year 2030. And the supplemental bridge option really is not a whole lot better than what the no-build option is. Particularly northbound, we see 7 hours of congestion there. And if we take a look at person trips, we can see that the replacement bridge option does have the best capacity to move folks across the river. When we take a look at what happens if we do nothing, and Mr. Tindall covered this a little bit earlier, without a project, we have 134,000 folks today. We would expect in the year 2030 for that to be 184,000 folks if we do nothing. With the project, we would expect 178,000 folks a day to actually be using the I-5 system, slightly less than what there is today. Under a supplemental option, we would see that as 165,000. So, actually, by building the project, we have less folks going into Portland than what we do if we do nothing. And the reason for that is because we give folks real choices with regards to transit, and because we expect to have a tolling component, which actually serves also as a traffic demand management tool.
I just want to make sure I understand that you have fewer cars going in, but you don't necessarily have fewer people going in.
Chair Beyer, Representative Tomei, that's correct.
Thank you.
Representative Dingfelder.
Thank you, and thank you, Madam Chair, for letting me sit up here and participate in, since my district is affected and by this project, and I'm very interested in this question I had is regarding the trips, and maybe you had stated this before, but how many trips that are crossing the bridge are actually going towards downtown versus just going right over the bridge into Jansen Beach? And the question I ask that is, of course, you know we have a sales tax differential, and that my guess is that many of those short trips are folks from Washington who are coming over to Oregon to shop. Is there any way to address those shorter trips that, and I'm wondering if the public transit will be addressing that for folks who are coming over from Clark County or Vancouver just to go to Jansen Beach to shop, that may be driving now, that there may be some way to, you know, move those folks, because that's my understanding of also why there's also a look at all those interchanges, correct, that will be improvements that are proposed as part of the crossing.
Chair Beyer, Representative Dingfelder, I think John can give you the specific percentages. They escape me right now about the number of trips that are with what are we call within the bridge influence area. They either start in that area, end in that area, or are totally within that area, and John can give you that number. In terms of the alternatives for the short trip, the transit options, whether it's bus rapid or light rail, I believe would have stops in the vicinity of the bridge, and so if you just wanted to hop across the river, you'd have that opportunity to stop close to the bridge and be able to use those alternatives to get across there, and obviously the bicycle and pedestrian facilities would afford that opportunity as well. John, you want to can you remember the stat?
Chair Beyer, Representative Dingfelder, approximately 70% of the traffic that flows across the bridge or through the bridge influence area either gets on within that 5 mile stretch, gets off within that 5 mile stretch, or does both. There's about 30% or a little more that starts north of the bridge influence area and goes straight through. And I don't have the numbers off the top of my head about the ones that get on in the bridge influence area and go on down to Portland, but I'm thinking that that is somewhere in the 30% range. So about 60% are coming straight through or get on in the bridge influence area and go on into downtown Portland.
Just a quick follow-up. Okay, so 70%, you said, are within that five-mile radius. Is that right? I mean, I'm just making sure I'm understanding this right.
The average trip length in the five-mile radius is about 17 miles. It's more than the five-mile radius. But there is approximately 70% of the traffic that crosses the I-5 bridge that either gets on within the five-mile section, gets off within that five-mile section, or does both.
So it's significant. Okay. Thank you.
With regards to cost for the project, right now there's five alternatives that are still on the table. So we have a fairly wide range. When we get down to one particular alternative, then we'll be able to narrow that range down. But currently we're looking at a $3.1 to $4.2 billion project in total. Of that, whether it's a replacement or supplemental bridge option, approximately $2.9 billion to $3 billion, a little over $3 billion would be the anticipated cost. For the high-capacity transit line, depending on the length and the mode that was selected, we expect that would run somewhere between $520 million to approximately $1.1 billion. So how would we pay for that? Right now, we have two states involved with the project. We would be looking for some portion of the project from each state. And we have tolling, which would contribute a significant portion of the project funding. And we also have Federal Highways discretionary funds or earmarks that we would anticipate for the project, as well as New Starts funding from the Federal Transit Administration, which essentially would pay for the transit component of the project itself. So really, what are some of the project benefits that we would expect to have? First and foremost, I suppose, we have a safer and more reliable transportation system that we provide to folks. We are able, with the project, to reduce congestion and improve mobility, particularly towards freight components. We give commuters real choices about transit, and we essentially are able to support the economies of two states by doing this project, and we also are able to improve the livability of our communities. So thank you. With that, I'd be happy to entertain any other questions that folks may have.
Representative Tomei?
Oh, thank you, Madam Chair. I want to respond, I guess, to the statement you just made about improving livability. I have some statistics about folks who live in the area of the I-5 bridge that the diesel particulate levels are 787 times what's considered safe. So if we if we have more cars traveling through that area, aren't we increasing that level, and aren't we compromising the health of folks who live in that area?
Representative Byer, Chair Tomei, what we find with the project is that by reducing the amount of congestion with the project over what we see, that we have much more efficient use of the engines, and the actual pollutant levels that are put out are less than what we would expect under a no-build condition. And with in addition, under a no-build condition, we would expect more autos to be going through the area with considerable increase in the hours of congestion, so we would see actually worse conditions by not building the project with regards to air quality.
Thank you. I can wait until everyone else.
Well, I just have some grave concerns, and I know that our time is running short, and I'm not sure that I can address them all now. But the sense I have is that a huge part of the problem is land use planning, that we have people who are living in an area that is less expensive to live in and are commuting down to the Portland area. And so the way we're dealing with that is it's about $2,000 for each person who lives in the Portland-Vancouver area is costing to aid in people who are living in areas where it's less expensive. I guess what I'm saying is that the public is having to supplement their living in an area. What's another word other than supplement? I'm trying to say.
Subsidize.
Thank you. Subsidize people who are living in an area where the property taxes are less and the property is less expensive. So we're subsidizing him $2,000 per each person to come to work in the Portland area. And I'm not sure that's a good use of either public money or, and that concerns me about the air quality, that we're just aiding and abetting more transportation. And it seems like what you're saying is 70% of the travel is within 5 miles of the river.
Chair Byer, Representative Tomei, that 70% number is a difficult number. We almost need a chart to show this. It's not 70% of the travel is within that 5 mile area. It means that 70% of the total number that crossed the bridge either start within that 5 mile area. It doesn't mean they start and end. They start in that 5 mile area, or they come from outside that 5 mile area and end in that 5 mile area, or they do both. The percentage that does both is not, as I recall, it's about 10 or 12%. So it's 10 or 12% that's only within that area. The rest of them are coming from outside. And they're either coming from outside and ending in that area, or starting in that area and going out of that area. But that's of the total trips that cross. It's 70% of the total trips.
Thank you,
Representative Dingfelder. Okay. Well, this is quick. Since I have the I-205 bridge in my district, and you're talking about tolling on the I-5 bridge, so what kind of modeling have you done to see how many people decide to take the I-205 bridge and skip the toll? Number one, and then two, can you talk about any modeling you've done to include congestion cost pricing to reduce the need for larger capacity?
Chair Byer, Representative Dingfelder, both of those will be factors in the financial analysis, and what we're doing in the financial plan is putting all of those cards on the table. Just the preliminary work we've done has variable rate tolling, so we do toll higher, even in just the kind of the back of the napkin stuff that we've gotten to now. We are tolling. The toll rates during peak hours are higher than they are during non-peak. We will analyze the tolling of I-5 alone, and the diversion is not huge, depending on what you put the toll at. But if you're around a $2 one-way toll, the diversion is not huge, is what the numbers are looking like right now. But we'll also look at what happens if you toll both bridges, and what finances do you generate in that scenario. So we will put all of that needs. What I'm trying to say is that we know a couple of things in general. We don't know all of the answers to your questions, but they will be answered in the financial plan, and you'll see that full range of all of those options about how this bridge could be funded.
Okay, thank you.
Madam Chair, that leads very nicely to what my question was, and you haven't reached this point yet, but how much of the proposed price tag would the tolling pay? Do you have a guess at that yet?
Chair Beyer, Representative Bence, if we toll both bridges, almost all of it, if we toll just the I-5 bridge, and just roughly the numbers without doing the sophisticated analysis to assure ourselves we've got the right diversion, but about a third of the cost if you toll the I-5 bridge and most of the cost if you toll both. Yep, about right.
What would... Representative Tomei.
Thank you. Following up there, what would the toll be? Did you already say that?
And I missed it. Chair Beyer, Representative Tomei, the toll that we talked about was it was $2.50 peak hour toll, $2.50 peak hour, and it went down to about, I think, 50 as low as 50 cents an hour during the middle of the night. I need to, one thing that wasn't real clear is that was an estimate in 2008 dollars. And so that's an uninflated cost, but those were the numbers that were discussed at the last task force meeting. And those are one-way numbers also.
I seem to recall in a previous meeting something like $13 the toll. But that must be the total cost, not just because you're depending on a lot of federal dollars coming into this.
Yes. Chair Beyer, Representative Tomei, I don't remember 13 in particular, but what we could have said is if you asked the question, how much would the toll have to be if you only tolled I-5 and wanted to pay for the whole bridge by tolling, the higher you get the cost, the more diversion you have, and so then you have to drive the cost even higher yet, and so it could have been something like $13. I don't remember that number, but that if you asked a question the other direction, that's the kind of number that you would get.
Follow up?
Yes.
So in a sense, could you look back on that? Maybe I'll look back on my notes too, because in a sense, then that's the true cost of that bridge would be $13. Maybe it was one way, maybe it was two way.
Chair Beyer, Representative Tomei, we'll look back and see what that number came out to be.
Thank you.
Representative Dinkum. It's just a follow-up to Representative Tomei's question. And first is, do we have existing authority for tolling, or do we need additional statutory authority?
We took care of that last
time. Yes, Chair Beyer, Representative Dinkfelder, we have existing authority.
And then can we toll on the I-205 bridge if we're not doing any improvements?
Chair Beyer, Representative Tomei, that's a fascinating question for which I don't know the answer yet.
Just because I'm sure I'd hear about it from all of my constituents who are going over that bridge.
We would, at a minimum, have to
the bike path.
Work through the, yeah, well, with something. We would have to, at a minimum, have to work through the federal government to toll that bridge. It's not blatantly allowable today. And whether or not, what hoops exactly we'd have to jump through to do it, we're still analyzing that, and that too will be part of the financial plan.
Well, if you do toll, I hope I take that bike path all the time and use some improvement.
Okay. We'll at least sweep it.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Well, we're running short, but... Okay, so how about Jerry Grossnickel and Rich Brown? So we can go a little longer, and as long as people will stay. When they start clearing out, you know, we overstay. Go ahead.
Chair Beyer, committee, my name is Jerry Grossnickel, and I represent the Columbia River Towboat Association. I'm on the Columbia River Crossing Task Force as well. I'd like to just talk about our position on this crossing. It's a little different from anybody else's. We see the bridge crossing from the river. And so my viewpoint is from the viewpoint of the tug and barge industry. And what we see when we're on the river, when we reach I-5, is a potentially catastrophic hazard. John talked about it just a few minutes ago, we do have a real navigation hazard at I-5, and it's because I-5 is so close to the rail bridge. It's within 0.8 of a mile, and we can only use the lifts during the non-congested parts of the day. And the congested parts of the day have been increasing. During my short tenure with the CRTA, Columbia River Towboat Association, we've had lots of pressure to increase those restricted times. We fought one of them back, we lost one. But the Coast Guard regulates this matter. And it is becoming increasingly difficult for us to sort of maintain our position here. But what makes it difficult is if we are not allowed to use the lifts, we have to come around to the what we call the wide span of the I-5 and go into the wide span and then make an S-turn maneuver to line up with the rail bridge. There's only one way through the rail bridge, and it's a very narrow opening. When the water is high, say over 4 feet, this can be extremely difficult and hazardous. Now, we've had several years of basically low water, but when we have high water, it can be extremely difficult to make that turn. We have, our tows are 12 to 15,000 tons. They're 650 feet long. They're 84 feet wide. When we arrive at the rail bridge, after making that S-turn, we have to line up straight with that opening because it's only 198 feet wide. And we have to power through it. Now, what this means is a major accident is inevitable. We have made this point time and time again with regulators, and we actually tried to do something about it 6 years ago this month. We called for a Truman-Hobbs hearing on this problem. It's extremely dangerous because we actually think it's inevitable that we're going to have a crash that is going to stop river navigation and rail navigation at the rail bridge. The Truman-Hobbs action we took, March 2002. We requested the study. The staff came from St. Louis and basically agreed with us. We have a very dangerous situation at the rail bridge, and it's caused by the fact that we can't use the I-5 lifts, because the I-5 lifts line you up with that rail bridge opening. So our suggestion, and they accepted this, was to move the opening of the rail bridge south, so that you could use the high span or the wide span of the I-5 and make it straight through. That would mean we would never have to use the lifts, which would be great, of course, for traffic. The recommendation was, let's go ahead and do that. Well, it got back to Washington, D.C. at headquarters level at Coast Guard, and they said no. The reason they said no is because in the regulations for Truman-Hobbs, it requires a cost-benefit analysis. And on the benefit side, the Coast Guard would not allow us to use the benefit to highway traffic. Obviously, we had to use that. When we stopped using the lifts, it's of great benefit to I-5. And so we used those figures. And they said we couldn't. Also, on the cost side, we couldn't use a speculative accident that's going to happen. We had to use the accidents that happened in the past. So for those two reasons, they said no. But they said we could use Truman-Hobbs if we got highway trust funds to do it. And so we approached Congress through our delegations. And originally, they were pretty enthusiastic about it, and we were crafting legislation. This has been done in other parts of the country. But we realized after talking with our representatives a few times that actually there's something going on in the state of Oregon and the state of Washington that might affect our problem. And that, of course, was this project, the crossing project. And so rather than push legislation through and change the rail bridge, let's look at I-5. What can be done? What will be done there with the crossing study? And we decided that, well, we got to get into action here. So I asked to join the crossing task force. And I must say that the staff of the crossing committee have been very accessible and rather quick about understanding the situation. The Coast Guard held a preliminary hearing on this whole problem in 2006. The CRC, Columbia River Crossing staff, provided a room full of drawings about prospective bench-type designs and where the piers might be. And they did a very good job. The staff is very aware that any new crossing on the river or any change to the current crossing will require Coast Guard approval. Coast Guard could stop the project cold. So they've been very aware of our problems because of that. And we've had many, many meetings, some called by us and some called by them. But they've been extremely cooperative in this effort. The CRTA, Columbia River Towboat Association, has voted to support replacing the old bridges with a new bridge that's high enough at the north end so that we can always navigate under the north end, lined up already with the current rail bridge opening. Of course, the piers of the current bridges, I-5 bridges, would need to be removed, and the channel has to be wide enough that we can always make that lineup. And if this is done, we believe there is a very good chance that we will avoid the catastrophic accident that our captains believe is inevitable.
Thank you.
Fascinating.
Who knew?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Richard Brown. I'm Senior Vice President of Market Development with Bank of America, but I am here today representing the Portland Business Alliance. I am a member of the 39-person Bi-State Citizen Task Force that has been studying the crossing for the past 3 years, and I'm testifying on the need to replace that bridge, and that is an official position that the Portland Business Alliance has taken and voted on. And I'm going to try to summarize these comments and give you a little bit of history as a part of my testimony. This process that we've been engaged in has been going on, as you've heard, for 3 years, but we have, officials from the Department of Transportation testified, this actually goes back even more than 10 years. Some of the initial things that we understand is this was looked at even as far back as 1977. So there's been a long time discussion about the need to improve this crossing around I-5. The original bridge, there's actually two spans, but the original span was built was designed in 1907 and built shortly after that. And it was actually an outgrowth of the Lewis and Clark Exposition. And so there was talk on both sides of the river of the need to replace the ferry system that was in place at that point. And actually they came to this legislature and the Washington legislature to get funding for the initial span of the bridge. The Washington legislature passed funding for the bridge. The funding got hung up in the Oregon State Senate, as I understand it. And so ultimately, the counties of Multnomah County and Clark County built that bridge, and they did it for about $2 million. But it was built as a horse and wagon bridge, and maximum speeds were 15 miles an hour. The bridge pilings are actually 60-foot Douglas fir timbers pounded into the river bottom sand. They're not even on bedrock. And it was a two-lane bridge. When it opened, there was only 20,000 vehicles in the states of Oregon and Washington. There's now over 4 million vehicles between the two states. And as we've heard, the bridge now carries over 135,000 vehicles per day, traveling at speeds of up to and sometimes over 50 miles an hour. The trucks that cross that bridge weigh 80,000 pounds. The initial span of that bridge when it was built, you know, there were no trucks, and the maximum load that any vehicle could carry ferry was 5,000 pounds. So obviously, the needs for carrying both people and freight across that river have changed dramatically since its original design and construction. And even with upgrades, you've heard about the safety issues, and they are significant. And then Jerry just talked about the lift span, and that bridge is lifted an average of twice a day, and that causes, even when they do it kind of at off-peak times, it does cause backups and bottlenecks, and it causes, as we've heard, challenges for those that are navigating the river as well. Our task force, we've been at this, as we've said, for 3 years. At our last meeting in January, I guess it was either early, maybe late January, early February, we had a meeting, and we took a straw poll, and there was near unanimous consent for the alternative for a full replacement bridge with light rail. And that is one of the five that is still on the table, but I just wanted to let the committee know that it does appear that our task force is moving toward that alternative. As we've gone through the process, there has been questions about, you know, can we grow ourselves out of congestion? And that is something that we've talked a lot about at the task force, and we've asked the staff to do a lot of research on it. But the modeling that the staff has provided to us shows that by building a bigger replacement bridge, we will not necessarily have more pollution as a result of more congestion, and part of that is we're having light rail and the tolling, which you've already heard about, and that tolling, as the previous testifiers told you, that it will include an element of some sort of congestion pricing. At least that's what they're looking at right now. Those will obviously be refined. But what we've been told by the staff is that if we did nothing, there would actually be 10,000 more cars moving across the river and more congestion than there will be if we build the bridge with a replacement bridge with the light rail, and some of that was discussed earlier. So net effect is fewer cars, better access for freight, less congestion, less pollution, and we certainly hope fewer accidents if we can deal with some of the safety issues. So I'll conclude my remarks at that point, and certainly happy to answer any questions that you have.
Thank you. Any questions? Well, you must have done a good job. So thank you for coming. Dave Tischer and Jonathan Schluter.
Chair Beyer and members of the committee, for the record, my name is Jonathan Schluter. I'm Executive Director of Westside Economic Alliance, based in Tigard. In that description, I'm describing the employers, the business developers and property managers of commercial office parks and retail malls, as well as the communities on the west side of the Portland metro region. I would hasten to add that I'm a constituent of Representative Reed in Beaverton and a member of the Columbia Crossing Task Force. Now, it may seem strange geographically. I'm probably the furthest removed from the Columbia River Project, and so I should explain why our group identifies the Columbia Crossing as one of the priorities that we want to see some solution to in 2008 and some progress made as part of the regional transportation picture for our region. What I would have you understand about the west side and Washington County and Clackamas County along I-5 from Lake Oswego's Cruise Way down through Tualatin to Wilsonville and the members that we represent is that we've identified 105 companies in Washington County alone that are shipping containers over the ports of Portland and Vancouver docks. So when I joined the crossing three years ago, it was in the interest of freight mobility. We needed to get our containers to and from the ports, to and from our customers, to and from their points of destination and distribution throughout the region. And so freight mobility was a key interest in that. But we learned something interesting along the way, and that is that 100,000 people woke up this morning in neighboring counties and came to work in Washington County just in the private sector. 15,000 of those folks don't even sleep in Oregon. They came here from neighboring states, many of them from Clark County. Indeed, 15,000 people are making the crossing each day, north and south. Three of my neighbors on Southwest Citation, Representative Reed, in your district, going to work in Clark County. One of them is an accountant, and I'll save that issue for another day, how they make that pencil. But the point is, people live where they choose and work where they can. And there is a lot of mobility in this region. We don't want to give up any of them for the competitiveness and the diversity that that brings to our community. That is key to our economy. That is 10%, 5% of our entire workforce in Washington County moving to and from across that Columbia Crossing Task Force daily. That is remarkable to contemplate in the mobility of our society. And it's the miracle workers at Providence St. Vincent's Hospital. It's the people that delivered the bread to our grocery stores in South Beaverton. It's the people that educate my child at Merlo High School in Beaverton. The principal lives in Battleground. You know, people live where they choose and work where they can. And we don't necessarily give up our place of residence, our neighborhood, our schools, our friends, our churches when we change jobs in our careers. The diversity is something that we must cultivate and we must nurture and we must encourage. And it's really boiled down to the issues of freight mobility, the ability to feed ourselves and fuel the economy that drives our state. It is the increased capacity of being able to get where we are going and get around. It is the issue of commuter access and enabling people to get to work in the morning and home to their families in the afternoon. It is system reliability, so that we know when to leave for work in the morning and how long it's going to take us or what mode of transportation we should take in order to get there reliably, on time, and safely. And the issue of public safety is really one that shouldn't be lost in all this discussion because you've heard the numbers. But to me, it is very persuasive that in a 5.5-mile stretch of interstate highway, you have 500 accidents a year, more than one a day. And I've heard the figure double the same distance, double the average of interstate highway travel for a corresponding 5.5-mile gauntlet of travel that people must endure as a daily habit. And that is too high. The delays, the dithering, the delays that we impose on ourselves in sitting at our table for 3 years trying to make these choices is a tough thing to wrestle with because people are being hurt. And people are being delayed, and it is costing our economy, it is costing our families. We can do better. Well, I think we've found a group of people in the Columbia Crossing Task Force that are willing and able to work together and find that solution. We've winnowed down the choices, considered public comments and consideration of opposing views for 3 years to bring the recommendations and alternatives that will be considered in the EIS process and ultimately for consideration later this year. I'm very encouraged by this whole process, and I think we can make this work. We thank you for your time and consideration.
Thank you.
Madam Chair, Committee, I'm Dave Tischer. I represent the task force for the Columbia Pacific Building Trades. I've been on the force now for 18 months. I came in about halfway through the process. We're basically a group of over 20,000 members representing over 1,000 employers in Oregon, Southwest Washington. We have approximately about a third of our constituency, both the members and the employers, are from Clark County. So we have approximately 7,000 members and about 350 employers. They work on both sides of the river. We have people commuting north and we have people commuting south. And the mobility is the key to both our members as well as our employers. They're having a hard time getting to work in the morning. They're having a hard time performing work on both sides of the river with getting their people across, their materials across. And one of the things I want to say is just having been in this process for about half of the 3 years they've been involved is the level of commitment from the staff. The transparency, the public involvement, it's just been extraordinary. They're to be commended for their ability to reach out to everybody. We support Columbia Pacific Building Trades, we support the replacement bridge alternative with the light rail. And light rail has been a very good thing on the west side. We have a lot of folks, a lot of our members work in the core areas of town, whether, you know, be Portland or Vancouver. And the west side light rail has done a great thing for our ability for our people to get to work. As you know, parking in the city of Portland is very expensive and very hard to come by. And our members have been very adamant that they want to see a viable source of rapid transit, you know, mass transit to get from Vancouver to Portland. And getting on a C-Tran and getting off the Expo Center and transferring to a light rail is just not a viable thing for most people. So I won't take up a lot of your time. I know everybody's trying to get out of here, but I appreciate you listening to my testimony.
Thank you. Any questions? Guess not.
Everyone wants to go home.
Thank you. And I don't see Gary Cardwell, so that is all the testimony that I had on my list. So thank everybody for coming.
Madam Chair,
yes.
Before we
close,
yes. Doug, are you still here? Okay. Could you get us information about the bottleneck at the Rose Garden in that area, even with the bridge? You don't need to do it now, but if you could get me information about that, how that will be affected with if a new bridge is built.
Come on up. Yeah.
Chair Beyer, Representative Tomei. There are other limitations, certainly, in the system, and the Rose Quarter bottleneck is one of those. But if you go back to what we had talked about a little bit earlier about the no-build versus the build scenarios, with less cars actually going through the bridge influence area and with the metering that exists, there's only 3 through lanes at Delta Park south of the system. This project does not contribute to more cars going into Portland. So that bottleneck does exist, and unless something is done, it will be there in 20 years, but this project will not necessarily make it worse because we're moving less cars in instead of more.
Thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you. We thank everybody, and I'm going to go ahead and close the informational hearing, and the committee is adjourned. Thank everybody for staying.